Now, just to remind you, you can get in contact and keep in contact with us on 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or call us on 07491 25000. Right, the Football Association of Ireland has apologised to female former international players and trainees on a FAS soccer training course who experienced alleged unwanted or inappropriate sexual advances from FAI coaches in the 1990s. We are joined on the programme now by Mark Tighe, Sunday Independent reporter and co-author of Champagne Football. Good morning, Mark. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries, Greg.
Right, this has been a huge piece of work for you and those working on it. I suppose take us back as far as you want and talk to us about the investigative process.
Yeah, so back in October 2021, myself and Marie Crowe from RTE Sports both started working on this separately initially for the first kind of 6 to 7 months. It was around the time that The Athletic, international sports website, had did a big investigation into Paul Riley, who was a coach in the US Women's Soccer League. And they, Sinead Farrelly, who's an Irish international, was among the whistleblowers that kind of exposed Paul Riley as someone who was using his position as a football coach to pressurize women into going into dates with them, and basically he was found to have sexually harassed players and was banned from US soccer for a lifetime ban. And at that time, Olivia O'Toole, who's Ireland's record goal scorer and record caps holder on the women's side, put out kind of a cryptic tweet, and Marie was in contact with Olivia, and I was in contact with her, and Olivia told me that if you think something like that didn't happen in Ireland, then you're joking with yourself. And I suppose from then, we both initially separately were working, trying to find out what she meant and what she was referring to. And Olivia was initially hesitant to kind of reveal what she was referring to, but she was referring to a specific football manager, international manager in the 1990s. And so in July, just 2 years ago now, 2022, myself and Marie, we met for the first time. So look, we're both working on this separately, and we agreed to pool our resources. And it was a unique then joint investigation between myself and Sunday Independent team and the RT Investigates team over the next 2 years to delve into this. And it was a really kind of arduous process to go around the country meeting all these women, and many of them didn't know about other women that had been affected like they had. And but they said, I think something might have happened with your woman, and we track her down and say, look, will you talk to us? And it took a long time for those women to build up trust in us to faithfully tell their story. And last Sunday, in the Sunday Independent, and we've done a podcast on the Indo Daily, and people will hopefully they can still see the Girls in Green document that went out Sunday night, and is available on the RT player now. We broke the story, and it's had a phenomenal impact. And as you say, the FAI reacted immediately yesterday morning, and I was there as the interim CEO David Correll said. He was angry and sad to witness what the women went through, and you know, he's offering them an apology, which I think is an important first step from the FAI.
Yeah, because, you know, and I can understand why it's termed as such, alleged unwanted or inappropriate sexual advances, but the words don't really sort of, I think, do justice sometimes to what people actually went through. You know what I mean? It feels far more severe than those words, if that makes sense.
Of course. Look, in Ireland we have draconian defamation laws, so... You know, there are certain other words you could use to describe it. Look, yeah. We've let the women describe what happened to them, and people can read that in detail still on our website or watch the documentary. This has been a phenomenally difficult piece of work. It's the hardest story I've ever worked on. And, you know, in terms of corroborating the story and standing it up and getting it through, countless meetings with, you know, not only the Sunday Independent lawyers, but also the RTE lawyers and that editorial process. So, yeah, like some of the stuff is just, it's horrific, it's harrowing in terms of what the women described. You know, one trainee describes, you know, how a coach asked her to stay back during a training session to help clean up the dressing room. And, you know, he came on to her in that dressing room, completely unwanted sexual advance. You know, I won't go any stronger than that, but, you know, people can, if they want to read full detail, it's there on our
story. And important sometimes we expose ourselves to that, because what this person in a position of trust with a person in a position of trust, and what should have been a safe space, you know, it's incredibly damaging just in the instant, but then subsequent to that. And I mean, in terms of getting a story like this over the line, you have to put an awful lot of work into it. What is the greatest challenge? Obviously, you have to build relationships with those who may want to speak their story, but also, you know, they can't be convinced of doing so, but they can be reassured if that's what they want to do. Is it building and forming those relationships and making sure all contributors are comfortable with it? Is that the biggest challenge, or is it circumnavigating the libel laws and other draconian systems we have in place here that stops more of this type of important work being done, I think?
Yeah, it's all of that. You know, you can't, you know, you have to make sure the women are trust you, but also, you know, you have to have a skeptical eye on what they're saying, you know, to make sure you reach a certain threshold that you're satisfied what they're saying is true. So that's a long process. You know, look, we have to corroborate their stories, see if they told people before, if they had, what had they told them at the time. So that a phenomenal amount of cross-checking that myself and Marie Crowe and the rest of the team and Frank Choldas, who was the producer, was a great help from RTE. So yeah, all of that. And we have to tell the women, you know, you have to trust us and be patient with us. You know, a lot of these people, they did their interviews late last year or early this year, and then we had to go off and cross check what they were saying, make sure it all stood up as far as we could, and then go through the legal process. We had to give obviously all the coaches a chance to respond, and then cross-check what they came back and said to us, and see if any of what they said undermined what the women's testimonies were. So, yeah, it's an arduous process journalistically to get something like this up the line. And yeah, I know, like we're both exhausted going through it. And because our defamation laws are so tight, you know, that's why these stories, these type of exposés in Irish media are incredibly rare. Mm. And it's, you know, but you know, I can only pay tribute to our editors in Independent, like Cormac Burke and Alan English and Paul Sheridan, my direct editors. And then I know everyone from Kevin Backhurst down in RTE, you know, would have been showing this and had contributions to make and insights. And that would all be fed back to us to see if we can tighten up certain things. So it's a very long and arduous process to get something like this out to where it's ready to go into the public and we can stand over it.
A lot of the allegations were made against the then head coach, Eamon Collins, who's still active in the game as a football agent. I know it's not necessarily a matter for you. Your investigation is out there now, but do we know what happens next in a scenario like this, given the strength of the allegations being made?
Well, there is an ongoing Garda investigation now. And just to say, I suppose Eamon Collins, when we approached him, we got a short statement from his solicitor who denies all inappropriate actions and all the allegations made against him. Some of them were clearly untrue. He didn't go into any further detail than that. He is a registered football agent. He would have been a previous manager of St. Patrick's Athletic, an assistant with Shelburne. He was the head coach of this FOSS course for 3 years. And, you know, in our reporting, the very first all-women's FOSS trainees soccer course, 5 out of 20 trainees told us that he made sexual advances on them in this 1996-1997 course. Since the FBI became aware of our investigation and spoke to some of the women, they have issued a stand-down order to Eamon Collins, which means he's unable to participate in any level of official football in Ireland. But he's still a registered agent with the Football Association over in the UK. His most famous client right now will be his nephew, Nathan Collins, you know, the Brentford and Ireland defender, who's had a number of big transfer moves in the last few years of 20 million plus, you know, which is obviously, as an agent, you know, that brings a lot of kind of financial resources back to him. So, yeah, it's a kind of a wait and see now what happens. There are ongoing investigations. We'll have to see what action the Football Association of the UK takes as well.
And just in relation to the Football Association of Ireland, you know, it's probably a very carefully constructed sentence that reads, "We're sorry that the modern practices and reporting structures that we now have in place were not there for you when you needed them." Has there been any reaction to this? Because that quite clearly says this is something that happened in the past and now it would be very unlikely to happen into the future. Has there been any reaction to that, or is that accepted as a stand-up statement?
Well, that wasn't the only kind of apology, but I think, yeah, the FAI are trying to take a part out of it.
It's just that jumped out of me to say it was the past and now things are different in the present.
Yeah, and I think when we were quizzing David Correll on this yesterday, and I think like he is to be commended for standing up and apologising to women, because he didn't have to say that, and legally, you know, people are saying, well, that kind of admit the FAI admitting liability, yeah. But that's for another day, I think, if anyone does take civil action. But yeah, we drilled into that and said, well, you know, what about women? And there's so many now in the League of Ireland women's team, you know, that weren't in existence back in the 90s. And the FAI and David Correll and Aoife Rafferty, the head of HR, admitted that the FAI policies that apply to the national team, where there's a hard and fast rule, if a coach engages in a relationship with a player, they can be dismissed mm-hmm. from their job and banned from football as well. You know, so those serious kind of rules and policies apply to the national setup and all the underage teams. But what they admitted yesterday is those rules do not apply to League of Ireland teams. So that's clearly something that, you know, I think it's a big area where they need to address it. You know, they said we're looking to bring in hard and fast rules and club licensing. So, but at the moment they say it's up to the clubs to police that. So I don't think that's acceptable. So that's clearly something, and we know just from our own contacts that there are women out there playing League of Ireland football who feel coaches are a bit too close to them or approaching them on their social media channels and things like this. So I think that's an area that if the FAI, I don't think they do think that this is all in the past. If they were to believe that this kind of thing where coaches are putting pressure on young women to engage in relationships, if they think that's all in the past, they are joking themselves now. But, and I hope that isn't the case. And I think they should address this League of Ireland issue and make it a hard and fast rule.
Yeah, OK, Mark. Now, if anyone wants to catch up on this, as you say, I think the original show is still available on the RTE player, the Independence content. You talked of the podcast and other material. How can people access that?
Yeah, so all our stories are up on the independent.ie website and the free two-part podcast, the Indo Daily with myself and Marie talking to Ellen Coyne, that's available now, going in depth into these stories and our investigative process. So all that material is widely available if people want to catch up in all the detail and listen to these women's testimonies firsthand.
Okay, Mark, thanks very much for your time. I really do appreciate it. Mark Tighe there, Sunday Independent reporter and co-author of Champagne Football. A report from the National Women's Council published today highlights shortcomings in perinatal mental health services in Ireland. The time limit on services provided after giving birth and the separation of mothers from their babies when inpatient treatment is required are identified as two issues of particular concern. Kate Mitchell is Head of Policy and Development at the National Women's Council and joins me now. Thanks for your time, Kate. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg, to you and your listeners. We're delighted to join you this morning. For anyone who hasn't heard of us, the National Women's Council is the leading national representative organisation for women and women's groups in Ireland.
Okay, so talk to us then about the key findings of this survey, so maybe sure we can dig a bit deeper if need be. So what are identified then as the shortcomings in perinatal mental health services in Ireland?
So as you rightly say, Greg, the National Women's Council has today published a report on perinatal mental health, really recognising that this is not an uncommon experience. One in five women will experience mental health difficulties in the perinatal period. And that really is that time during pregnancy and for 1 year after birth. And the report does recognise that there have been very positive developments in this area, and that's been really driven through the National Maternity Strategy and through the perinatal model of care that was launched in 2017 and more recently through our current National Mental Health Sharing the Vision. But despite those developments, there are still real significant gaps for women and particularly for marginalised groups of women in accessing perinatal mental health services and supports which effectively meet their needs. And there are a wide range of gaps in this regard in terms of access to specialist services. We're seeing a huge increased demand and pressure on these services, with actually a doubling in numbers of referrals and appointments in recent years. The absence of a mother and baby unit, which you've already alluded to, which is a critical component of the perinatal mental health model of care. So currently, where women do require inpatient care and support, they're actually separated from their babies and admitted to general adult inpatient
units. Which happens more often than we would like, of course. You hear of that really quite regularly.
And it's not international best practice. We know from extensive research and evidence that mothers and babies should remain together. The mother and baby units are designed specifically to keep mother and babies together, so that the woman can receive that mental health care and support that she requires, while also really nurturing and supporting that mother-infant relationship, which we know is so critical to the health and mental health of the woman herself, for the infant, as well as the full family unit. But I suppose that is just one element of it. It's a critical component, but we need to see increased capacity across all specialist services, but also within primary care. We're facing really significant challenges in terms of a lack of GPs, under-resourcing of GP capacity, other primary care professionals, including primary care psychology, the number of public health nurses, where in some locations there's actually a public health nurse missing, you know, that can provide support within that area. But there are also other issues in terms of the period of care that is provided.
Well, just in relation to that, because I think there is an important part of this about sort of public recognition of the reality of this situation. So often a new mum might experience anxiety, depression, or other complex mental health disorders. And the general public consensus might be that, well, that's after a week or two or 3 weeks, and they get back up at the feet and everything will be grand. But what we do know from the statistics is that there's an actually increase 3 months after birth, with the highest instances of the likes of anxiety and depression 6 months after birth, which I think is quite interesting. It might be some new information to even new mums out there, because I've spoken to new mums before, and they know something is not there, but they're always, well, it's not postnatal depression, or it's not this, that, and done, because I had the baby 3 or 4 months ago. It can't be that.
Absolutely. And we know that from research, and there's been some really excellent research published through Trinity College Dublin, which shows that we actually can see an increase in perinatal mental health difficulties at, you know, the 3 month, but also 6 month, 9 month and 12 month mark. So we really need to be extending, you know, the typical period of care for a woman postpartum is 6 weeks, but really we need to be extending that much further, but also that it is not one size fits all. So we need to see that enhanced capacity and resourcing of a very wide range of supports within primary care, but also community supports as well, which can really support, you know, a very significant number of women, but very critically that increased capacity within specialist perinatal mental health service as well. And I would also say that it's really critical that we're addressing the particular needs of marginalised groups of women. We know that they face particular barriers in terms of access, experience and outcomes. And there is a dearth of, you know, research and data available. So one of the things that we're calling for, you know, through publication of this report, is actually a national research training and education centre. We need a national research strategy that can look very extensively at the particular needs of women and all their diversity, including marginalised women, so that we can really clearly identify the challenges that women are experiencing, but also responding to those. And we have a really critical opportunity here through the updated model of care for perinatal mental health that can really look at, you know, a very wide range of services and supports to meet the needs of women. And women's voices really need to be at the heart of that. It's also a very opportune time as well. We have an upcoming budget, of course, possibly in the coming weeks, where we need to see a very firm commitment to investment in perinatal mental health and resourcing of those services. And of course, an upcoming general election as well, where we need government to really commit in the next programme of government to perinatal mental health.
I think there kind of has to be a couple of strands to this as well. You know, a long-term commitment or some sort of recognition of the findings is not enough in and of itself. There are short-term and medium-term, as well as a long-term strategy, but short and medium-term measures that really need to be looked at.
Absolutely. And I think the current model of care has been very effective in terms of starting to drive those developments and meeting those needs. But what we are seeing is that there are particular areas that need to be met that aren't covered under the current model of care, particularly around meeting the needs of marginalised groups of women. So through this new model of care, we really have a really good opportunity to address those gaps and really improve services for women, but also through kind of longer term commitments as well through the upcoming programme of government. But there needs to be that investment as well through annual budgets as well to see those pragmatic and incremental developments as well.
And not to pick holes in it, it's just a question, does this report catch geographical differences in the availability of care?
It doesn't go into, I suppose, the specific challenges with particular areas or geographical locations, but I suppose it does touch on, you know, when we talk about the perinatal mental health model of care, it operates under a hub and spoke model. So we have six hubs which operate through the maternity services with the highest birth rates, and they provide the very specialist services. So they're consultant-led multidisciplinary teams. But then we have perinatal mental health midwives operating across all 19 maternity units. And I suppose one of the key things that is emerging from, you know, looking at the current model of care is that there are huge challenges there in terms of there's a lot of pressure being put on the spoke models because they don't have the same capacity and resource as the hub sites. So it's really critical that we're looking at that in the context of the new model of care to ensure that all communities are properly resourced, you know, that we're not operating, and we often do in terms of mental health service delivery, operate in the context of a postcode lottery. So we need to ensure that every woman, no matter where she lives, no matter what community she resides in, that she's getting a high quality level of service and care that appropriately meets her needs.
Interesting. Kate, listen, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. That's Kate Mitchell, Head of Policy and Development at the National Women's Council. I mean, if you go for your checkups with your local health nurse, obviously there's an awful lot of attention on the baby. Your mum's routinely asked, how are you feeling? Are you feeling down or anyway? Or, you know, I just wonder how people are signposted to these various services and sort of what they're like or how they're delivered for us here in the Northwest. If you have any insight into that, 086 60 25,000. The caller says, Greg, that parent not giving the child a phone at 12 years of age is quite admirable. Our son got his as 13, but there were rules attached and also a parent control put on it. He's now going into secondary school and a mobile will be part of his school routine with Microsoft Teams being set up by the school for communication. I think you've struck the perfect balance there, to be honest with you, because often we like to have them having a phone as well, don't we, so we can make contact with them. But once you've got the parental controls put in place, it means that you're also discussing the fact that, you know, there's stuff on that phone that you shouldn't be accessing. So that kind of has that conversation as well, which we try and avoid conversations, tough ones sometimes. So I think you've got the right balance there. I mean, the other listener, their son or daughter, I'm not sure which, wasn't getting a phone at 12, but they weren't going to get one at all, not even at 17. Just to follow up, the black horse, I think it was a black pony, it was described in an earlier text, but anyway, maybe it's the horse's owner. Just to thank the person who put the black horse into a field for safety this morning, really appreciated. So it'd be nice if that was the owner of it actually and was able to go and pick up the horse and take it home. It would be a nice end to that story. Hi, Greg. The toilets at the Abbey Hotel Donegal Town always locked, customer use only. I'm not sure. I've never seen them locked before. I have had occasion when I'm in there to go into them, not necessarily from the street, and I've never spotted that. Maybe. And you know what? I wouldn't be surprised if they did. Why should businesses be providing bus shelters and public toilets because the local authority or the council or the country isn't? Hi, Greg. There are still two posters up of an MEP candidate in our draw. That comes in from Teresa. Teresa, who? Let us know. We'll pass. We'll get on to them. Could I guess who? I think I possibly could. I'll tell you, Teresa, you tell me, and then I'll tell you if my guess was correct. But I have a guess who I believe it to be. Well, I can't say it on air. I can't say it on air. But I have a guess, and we'll see. So as I mentioned, Rory Gallagher's battered guitar, as it's been described in this article, could be set to fetch more than €1 million when it goes to auction this autumn. The 1961 Fender Stratocaster could earn between 828 and 1.8 million euro. It's part of the collection, which consists of an exceptional collection and selection of guitars, amps and accessories from his life and career offered by the Gallagher family. Rory's brother and former manager, Donald Gallagher, confirmed the auction was taking place. And he said, since 1995, I've always felt that there was a mission to be fulfilled to cement Rory's legacy and further widen the knowledge of his music. But some people want at least part of his stuff to remain in Ireland. Anne-Marie joins us now. Anne-Marie, sorry for the long intro. It's just for those that didn't hear a little earlier on that maybe weren't aware of what we were going to talk about. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Right. Now, a petition has been started by a group, which includes you, of course, I think, supporters of the rock community to get at least the guitar kept in the country. Why would that be so important, do you think?
Well, I mean, like, Rory Gallagher is out there as lauded as being one of the best guitar players ever. So he is. I mean, like, the likes of Slash and Sir Brian May would look on him as they were influenced by him. So they were, like, he's their icon. We can't see past what he has done for guitar playing and musicians and the world today. Like, you know, a lot of people that we would look up to have picked up the guitar because of Rory Gallagher. And I mean, like, one of his guitars is that, if you look at it, that beat up looking Fender Stratocaster, the one where the paint has all come off it. If you think on Rory Gallagher, the first image comes into your head is that Stratocaster. Now, Donald has the legacy for all Rory stuff. He is his manager, he's his only brother. And fair play to him, like, he's kept all that stuff for the past 30 years since Rory has passed away. But now he's putting it up for sale. But, I mean, that's his choice to do that. But I think for the sake of music and arts and culture, that Stratocaster should be kept in Ireland. Mm. I don't think that Stratocaster should be sold on to a buyer to be kept in a house somewhere.
For their own personal pleasure, indeed.
For their own personal pleasure.
Yeah.
You mean, that's significant. I mean, back in 2006, there was an actual, how would you put it? Like, there were guitars from different guitars all over the world. Some passed away, some still with us, that was on display in the National Museum of Ireland, the Collins Barracks.
Mm-hmm.
Mickey had Jimi Hendrix's guitar, Bob Dylan's guitars, Phil Lynott's bass, Carlos Santana, and Van Morrison, and it was all under the guise of Life and Times of Electric Guitar from 31 to 2006, and some of Rory's guitars were there as well. So, I mean, like, it has been on display in the National Museum of Ireland before in Collins Barracks, so mm-hmm. why not try and get this one, get the government to purchase this one guitar or more if they can afford it.
Like, I think part of it too, Anne-Marie, there's a couple of things going on here. Firstly, this Stratocaster and the condition it's in, and those watching the show are actually seeing some footage of Rory play it. If it was pristine, it probably wouldn't actually feel as important as it does. But, I mean, it's so recognisable and it's so played, so it's so connected to him. But also, too, I hope we don't regret in 50, 100, 150 years in maybe not recognising and archiving popular culture. You know, pop culture, it would have been pop music at the time, albeit rock music at the time. But this is as important as a famous harper, a famous fiddler, or a famous baron in 50, 100, 150 years. You know, there's a responsibility, isn't there, for us to sort of try and retain at least some of these items?
There is, Greg. I mean, like, it's like everything was popular at one stage. I mean, like, we, at the minute now, I think in the Ulster Museum in Belfast, there's two Caravaggio paintings in there that you can go and look at.
Mm.
But back whenever they were painted, they were popular culture. So, like, why can't we look at the guitar as the same thing? I mean, Rory has passed. His legacy is there. Don't let his legacy be sold out of the country. This is important to as important to the country as anything else within popular culture that could go into a museum.
Yeah.
I mean, For us especially, I mean, maybe in the rock community, like we look at it more because we realise the influence that Rory has had on the music that we listen to and has come down through the years. I mean, like when you have people out there who are fantastic guitarists in their own right saying that Rory was the best, I mean, and he was born in Ballyshannon. You were just talking about Ballyshannon mm-hmm. an hour ago with Dr. Joe. Like, so, I mean, we can't see past the significance of it.
Well, people already, we can't be snobbies, and no one is either, right? But we talked about Allingham's amazing contribution to the arts 200 years ago. I mean, what would we give to have, you know, some of his original works? And I'm sure there are some about, but, you know, if not already, certainly in the years to come, Rory Gallagher's name will be mentioned in a list, including Allingham.
Yeah, of course. And then the thing, like, there's an Allingham Festival, but there's also a Rory Gallagher Festival.
Right, yeah.
Like, there is people down in Ballyshannon, the committee, who have pulled it together, and it was 20 years going. So, I mean, look at some of the names that have played that festival over the years. Like, I mean, you had Bernie Marsden, who played guitar in Whitesnake, and sadly has passed away this year. So he has, but Bernie Marsden was there a good few times. And like you had Yuli John Roth this year. Last year you had Michael Schenker group playing. I mean, these people don't come over to play that festival just because. I mean, it's because of Rory.
Mm-hmm.
It's the significance of Rory, why they were there. Like, they would have come up playing along with Rory. You know what I mean? On different bands. I mean, they would have probably crossed paths as they were touring. I wonder if,
and this is kind of unfair, but I wonder if Donald Gallagher was approached, would he work with the government? I mean, obviously, listen, there has to be a financial element to it, but I wonder if he were approached, would he work just even on the Stratocaster, work with the Arts Council or something to try and secure, because it doesn't even have to stay in Ireland. Listen, if it's in someone's back bedroom in Sligo or Mozambique, I'm not sure it makes much odds. It really needs to be in public display. I just wonder if the Arts Council or whomever, I don't know who would be responsible, the Arts Minister or whomever, if the Gallagher family could be spoke with to sort of maybe with. That being said, this is the key item, and I suppose the whole auction kind of. It's a toughie, really, isn't it? It's a tough one to figure out a solution for.
I mean, you can imagine that is going to be the one guitar that's going to probably make the most money at auction out of all his guitars and equipment. But again, because of the significance of it, I don't think it should leave the country. But personally, I don't know Donal. I would like to think that he would be willing to work with the government or the arts part of the government if he was approached. But I mean, we need to talk about it because there's no point in getting to October, everything's auctioned off, and then complaining about it. You know, like closing the stable door where the horse
just
was
I'm sorry for laughing, but while you're speaking, we're watching a video here of Rory Gallagher dragging this guitar across the stage by its cable. I'll think, you're bloody hell, Rory. But I think that really...
I mean, like, it's as good as Jimi Hendrix setting his on fire, you know what I mean?
He's lambasting the thing now. All right, okay, well, sure, we'll see. As you say, you know, often these conversations happen a day before or in the weeks after.
Well, sure, this is it.
The campaign
is
out there now.
The petition's out there if anybody wants to sign it. Like, and I think Caroline has it there.
Well, we'll share it. Let's listen to a bit of Rory.
Happy
Take
days.
Care. Bye.
Thanks a million, Greg. Bye.
Indeed, and that's Rory Gallagher playing the very guitar that we're talking about. Okay, it is the 9 till noon show here in Highland Radio. As I say, I just think it's really important that we make sure that we, like, we kind of have a, I think we have something of an obligation to ensure that these items are available to view for visitors, but also for future generations. Hi, Greg. My aunt, who passed away a year ago, had scoliosis. And it was not diagnosed until later in her life. And they then could not do anything about it. It caused her a lot of persistent pain, and she would not have been considered a severe scoliosis case. What has happened with the missing 19 million euro unaccounted and misspent funds, illegally spent? Well, we don't know if they're illegally spent, but anyway, they've been spent where they shouldn't have been spent. Quite apparently, this caller says, is not right. Dozens of young people will be ruined for life, and it's just not a big deal for the Dublin bureaucrats. Let's just focus on reducing the waiting lists, according to Micheál Martin. Well, that was the sole purpose for the 19 million euro. Indeed, I understand where you're coming from. That is a big deal, a big story, all right. I get you. Just read a headline a couple of days ago on Highland Radio about vehicles damaged in the Derry Hospital car park. I had my car damaged whilst I was in Letterkenny University Hospital attending an appointment. I was only in the hospital for around an hour. My car was parked in the first row outside the main entrance. I was horrified at the damage. My windscreen was all cracked, and on my return to the vehicle, I contacted the ticket office and they directed me to security. I met with a middle-aged security person who informed me that there was no security camera covering the front of the hospital, which I found astonishing. Just wondering, in this day and age, with so much crime going on, as to why there would be no security camera covering the main outside. Would like to find out more. What frightens me that if someone was approached or attacked in that car park, no CCTV would be produced. A concerned listener. That's interesting. Interesting couple of points there. We'll double check with the hospital about the CCTV coverage just to ensure the story. I mean, I've spoken to nurses, particularly a couple of nurses over different times who've come out and their cars have been very badly damaged. I know there was some referenced that in previous episodes of the Community Guard information. So the fact that there's not full coverage, CCTV coverage across that whole park, is that not what the parking charges are for, to ensure that all cars are there safe and secure? That's why I'm surprised there's not blanket CCTV coverage. So just in case there was a faulty camera at that time, we'll get in contact with the hospital and find out what the story is. And also, I would like to find out, if we're putting that together now, who's responsible for that CCTV footage. Are the people that we pay the car parking charges to, are they responsible for making sure that the entire lot is covered by CCTV footage? I think that's two decent questions that we are entitled to answers for. Brendan Devaney, presenter of the DL Debate podcast, is with us now. Good show last night, Brendan, live from Highland Motors. It's available for you to listen back to as well. Good show, very entertaining.
Thanks very much, Greg. Yeah, that's what we'd have to do. You entertain them more than you pack and everything into these 3 hours every day, laptop. So,
yeah, now Mickey Hart, he stepped down as Derry manager. Mutual agreement, I imagine. One season in charge, this following Derry's All Ireland quarter final exit at the hands of Kerry. I mean, that's the timeline of it following that. I don't think he left off the back of it, but that's just how it's written. It's a difficult one, isn't it? A great start, then a bit of an old mess, then maybe a bit of an uptick towards the end, and who's to say what could have happened next year?
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. Listen, it's been... Do you remember that show about Brian Clough, the Damned United? Where he took over Leeds very controversially and didn't last too long. Well, a 10-month tenure, you know, for someone to come with everything that happened, certainly he'll look back with a regret of taking the job. It raised so many eyebrows. And, you know, we're talking about John O'Mahony's sad passing last night in the show, and that was a Mayo man within the Galway. But the rivalry between certain counties just isn't as deep. And in Ulster, it's very deep. And it's very deep with certain counties in particular. And Derry and Tyrone certainly have that. And not just because of the rivalry, but because of what Mickey Hart represented. He was Tyrone. You know, he took Tyrone from a period where they'd never won an All-Ireland, they won it 3 in his tenure and everything he'd done at underage. He was, like, you'd have to say, in Donegal terms, you know, you look at people like Brian McNuff and Anthony Molloy, now Jim McGuinness. To imagine them all managing a real rival county if they were at the peak of their powers, it would be a very strange scenario. So the fact that he did take the Derry job, everyone was so shocked at it. And looking at it, Greg, I think that the whole scenario around Rory Gallagher's departure and the fact that there was a lot of legalities in the background of that, but I'd heard rumours in Derry that there was a cohort of people involved that were trying to get Rory Gallagher back, and then there was this can't happen, that can't happen. And I don't know then that the county board jumped in, because don't forget, he was supposed to coach Louth this season, and they were very disappointed that he left along with Gavin Devlin, because they were showing, I suppose, signs of improvement throughout the 2 years he was in charge. So even though they've had a great season under Ger Brennan since, he left Louth under a bit of a cloud, came into Derry under a massive cloud, and he's left.
It kind of feels like if you could go back a year, perhaps different decisions could have been made. And I wonder to the reaction to his appointment for the reasons that you've talked about, and not necessarily for the quality of the football on the pitch. You know, a lot of noise from some high-profile people around his appointment as well. That's part of the cloud that you're talking of, because it's not a great way to get your tenure underway.
Yeah, I thought some of that was out of order, Greg. Of course, you're speaking about Joe Brawley and that. Some of the language is used, I thought, was way too far, particularly when it comes to, you know, it's GA. And I know it is a paid position, but we are supposed to have a bit more of a community around it all. And even though you're not happy about something, I think there's a certain level of, you know, critique, or you can have your say on it, but you can't go too harsh in terms of it gets a bit personal. And I thought that was out of order for Mickey. Certainly he'd done enough to earn his respect in the game. But yeah, listen, there was so many question marks going into it in terms of succeeding. And I think, Greg, he's just was human going into it. Now, he has this famous record with the McKenna Cup, and no one took that much heed of that. And I often said about the night they beat us in the final, it was January up in Healy Park, and Tyrone or Derry just looked at such a brick up there in Healy Park in terms of defensively, the way they were playing. They really looked on the money. But even then, you're thinking, right, you don't want to be going too good too soon. And when he hit the league, they were out playing teams who weren't at their, you know, at their at the same level in terms of preparation or the amount of top players they would have on the pitch. So there was these question marks, but then you were thinking in the modern game, condensed season, maybe Derry are just on this trajectory where they're going to come in and this is going to be their year. But then it all fell apart. I mean, the three defeats, and there were three real big defeats in Championship, and most notably it goes to Donegal and to Armagh at their home patch. I mean, that, of course, really rocked the whole Derry faithful. And you're right, he did somewhat stable the ship stabilised then with the last two games, Greg. And you wondered, was it enough to maybe give him a second shot? But obviously, the pain they're going through previous to that, and the sound bites coming out from the camp.
But there was also, as you mentioned, there was some talk too of some disquiet. And I think your phone might be sitting on its speaker, Brendan. No, it's just to make sure I can hear you. There was some disquiet within the camp as well. Is that linked to the manager or not the manager, whatever? But what's next, though? Because, I mean, you know, Rory Gallagher is in the clear. He had a job to do. He was in the process of doing it. There seems to be quite a bit of support for him coming back into the fold.
Yeah, that is a difficult one. I think it would be people talking about PR disasters. You know everything that happened in there. You know, it's still in terms of a GA. It's more a legal matter, and then it's how those two sides work it out around what happened and what is the outcome in terms of stopping a player becoming a manager. Obviously, the Ulster Council had put a ban on him, and you know, apparently there's. I heard rumours in the background that's been challenged. So whether that's something Derry want to take on board, I think there's two very big sides to that around how that would play out. But I think if you're looking at someone that Derry people would want, it's Malachy O'Rourke. Obviously, he's coached a couple of club teams in Derry, Fermanagh and Monaghan. He's done really well with them all. Every team he's went to, he's brought them on. And currently, Glenn, you know, back-to-back All-Ireland finalists, winning the All-Ireland club title, there's no doubt in the effect that he has had in those, and he would be definitely the man everybody would want back in. I think Rory, no matter what way it plays out, would be ultimately hugely controversial. That said, you know, we obviously had a serious bond with these players.
Yeah, and then there's legal responsibility, moral responsibility, and as well to go from one controversial appointment to another controversial appointment, and what impact that has on the pitch as well, though it shouldn't, but they have an option there too, so it's not like they're, you know, there is an option there as well. Okay, Brennan, we'll see how it pans out. Go ahead, yep.
Very few, you see, great people out there. And again, we're just blessed to have Jim McGuinness. You know, if you look at brilliant managers around the country, you know, you'd have to say Jim Gavin, Jim McGuinness, you know, Jack O'Connor, the record, but they're not going to come to your county. They're not really available. If you look at even the legend of Colm O'Rourke and Glenn Ryan, how they're struggling at Kildare and Meath and that. The problem is that real high-level manager that Derry seek, you know, there's really very few out there in the country. And say, I think for Derry fans, Malachy O'Rourke's the only man that would fit that bill at the minute, whether he wants to leave Glen or not. as I say, we're just lucky we have Jim as our man at the minute.
A caller says, Greg, near the end of Mickey Hart's time as Tyrone manager, Tyrone wanted to get rid of him, but he wouldn't go. Then as Louth manager, they wanted him to stay, but he walked away on them for Derry, where the majority of Derry people didn't want him. They say Tyrone fans are having the last laugh at him. But I think real Tyrone fans would recognise the work that he's done for them and the great days out that he's delivered them. We don't want to sort of, do we descend into United versus Liverpool, Rangers versus Celtic? I mean, you know, it's an amateur sport, as you say. I know he's paid, but we don't want that. We don't want to get too toxic, do we?
No, listen, Greg, it's one of them ones. I just feel sorry for Mickey in terms of this. And, you know, at his age...
Legacy is a big deal here.
It was like Paddy Carr when he got the Donegal job and it all went wrong. It was at the end of his time, if you like, in terms of real management. And if you look at Mickey now, the future's with lower division teams. He can go into a team like Louth and bring them up in terms of what he brings, Greg. But if you're looking at high level, the top level things, time moves on and it's changed so much for him. And I think that's why he struggled a bit at Derry this season. And you know, it all ended badly, I suppose. But listen, where the future is for Mickey now, I can't see him having what you'll call a top team again. Times have moved on. They've changed so much around what a manager needs to bring to a team. That's why, as I say, there's very few out there. And for me, the only person, and I would be worried about him getting a job as a Donegal fan, would be Malachy Arroyo.
There you go. And we can't forget, too, that outside of his football work, Mickey Hart contributes a lot as well and does a lot of other stuff that's very important. Right, thanks very much, Brendan. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye. Okay, that is Brendan Devaney there. If you have a view on that, we won't get to your comments today, but we certainly will tomorrow. 086 60 25,000, the WhatsApp and text. Just a bit of news as it relates to potential flights and what have you. We didn't mention this earlier on, but I just want to give it a quick mention now. Hopes of an end to the Aer Lingus strike have risen after the airline accepted a Labour court recommendation of a 17.75% pay hike for pilots last night. Aer Lingus said it would agree to the proposal, which followed meetings involving management and the Irish Airlines Pilot Association in order to end the enormously damaging dispute. IALPA said the union's executive would meet within the next 24 hours to consider the suggestion ahead of a ballot of members. Now, which I don't think is really a good faith act. They're, unless something's changed since I've been on air, they're not prepared to suspend their action whilst that ballot's taking place, which, as I say, you know, considering how it affects the public and how it would ease a lot of anxieties out there, I think they could definitely suspend that action until such time as they get the findings of that ballot. All right, have a fantastic Tuesday, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9. Stay tuned. John Breslin's around the Northwest after the news headlines at 12.